Thanks. Yeah, I guess that's really should be rain plus. Yeah, so maybe just a slight revision of the title, but what I want to talk about today is sort of how different degrees of freedom are sometimes secretly mixed together, and how we might want to, well, in string theory, and when we need to break them apart. So this is going to be much more of a supergravity kind of perspective, and applications towards, well, compactification is the kind of thing that I have in mind. So the idea is that what I want to talk about is sort of a type of like diagonalization of different modes. But really, it's not you know, about mixing of modes sort of at the level of the action in the usual sense, but it's really of finding maybe I'll wait for the glare to go. But it's about finding sort of what you might call hidden explicit dependences. Okay. Maybe it's better to read now. Okay. That are sort of caused by Bianchi identities. So let me explain a little bit more by talking about what, well, sort of mention some things that I'm not talking about as a contrast. So why am I thinking about this? But one is, we're talking about sort of modern, well, by modern, I mean most of the last 20 years or so. We're talking about modern compactifications with background field strength fluxes and warping. They're actually still basic questions regarding how to derive the EFT. So, you know, if you just have a product compactification, Minkowski by Calabi-Yau or something, it's long been known and very well understood how we understand what the four-dimensional effective field theory is of that. But even in sort of the most basic warped and flux compactifications, like those, well, sort of made famous by Giddings, Kacher, and Polchinski, there's still issues with sort of understanding that derivation. And if you start talking about twisted or non-geometric ones, it gets even worse. So some of the issues that come up are looking at, well, gauge constraints from some components of the 10-dimensional equations of motion. These are analogous to, say, the Hamiltonian constraint of gravity, that you have to impose sort of before or in order to identify what the correct translation of 10-dimensional to 4-dimensional degrees of freedom are. And these essentially mix 10D degrees of freedom in a single 4-dimensional mode. And this was first pointed out a long time ago by Giddings and Majorana, but there's been a fair amount of work following that over the years, trying to be a little bit more explicit about solving these constraints. In some cases, there are possibly actually gauge transformations that can eliminate what look like two distinct 10-dimensional modes. And so you actually have fewer four-dimensional degrees of freedom than you would think. And this is analogous to what happens in cosmological perturbation theory, which relates, for example, the spatial curvature of the metric to like the fluctuation of a scalar in inflation, for example. Okay. And sort of similar to cosmological perturbations. And this was pointed out by Brett Underwood again a while ago, but I think it's not very appreciated. So these issues, for understanding the basic questions of how do we know what the four-dimensional theory is that comes out of a given compactification background, seems okay, it's sort of basic importance if we want to understand any kind of phenomenology out of string theory from a higher dimensional point of view. But also, I think right now there's been a lot of discussion of swampland conditions and criteria, whether or not certain things are possible solutions that arise out of a 4D effective field theory. You might want to know what that effective field theory is or how to identify it and be precise about it. So I want to talk about a sort of a different kind of mixing or basic question here. And this is sort of a definitional mixing of 10D sort of modes in string theory by non-trivial Bianchi identities. So, namely, going back to work on magnetic monopoles by Wu and Yang, we know that potentials with non-trivial Bianchi identities have to be patched together by, you know, gauge transformations. So there's two different patches where there's two different potentials in different gauges that are gauged together. Okay. But if the source, the magnetic source, fluctuates, then that fluctuation also changes the patching. And what that means is there's some hidden dependence of the potential on what the source is doing. Not just the usual implicit dependence, but also one that's sort of hidden in the Bianchi identity, which is sort of in some ways lower than the action level or a more fundamental level, right? It tells us what the degrees of freedom are before we even write an action for them. Okay. So fluctuating sources in some ways change the almost the definition of the potential. This is different, right, than an electric source. If you have an electric source fluctuating, then the potential changes, but only because of the equations of motion. It's sort of not as part of its definition of a degree of freedom. That's more of an implicit dependence, and it doesn't change how you derive the equations of motion. What I'm trying to say is from a calculus of variations perspective, calculus of variations point of view, this is an actual explicit dependence of the potential on the magnetic source. So if you vary, say, if you're doing Maxwell theory with magnetic monopoles and you vary the position of the monopole, you have that, your vector potential patched around the monopole, you should really also be varying that potential with respect to the position. And it's not, you know, a closed form variation, but you should be doing it. So it's hidden. We don't know what it is a priori, but there's an explicit dependence of the potential on the magnetic source. So if there's nothing else you remember today, this should be the key thing. And again, this is unlike diagonalizing things at the level of the equation of motion. It's not like coupled harmonic oscillators or anything like that. It really is sort of more fundamental even than the action. So it's telling us what the degrees of freedom are. So here's an example. And sort of the simplest one I can think of and comes from work I did 17 years ago with Joe Polchinski, and he sort of taught me about this. But let's imagine we've got just a conformally Klabiel compactification with harmonic background three-form fluxes in 2B. So we have F3 and H3. Then, okay, because they're harmonic background fluxes, the RR and NS and S2 forms, they're not periodic or they're not globally defined. They're gauge patched. But if you look at the first order, and if you look at the Bianchi identities, right, the fluctuation of F3 and H3 should be some nice periodic kind of function. So the fluctuations of C2 and B2 are globally defined. However, I'll move this up a little bit. But the five-form field strength, right, has this kind of so-called transgression term in it. So fluctuations, if I take the first order part of this or the fluctuation part of this, there's a background C2 with a fluctuation of H3. That background C2 has this gauge patching on it. It's not globally defined. So even the fluctuation of C4 is still gauge patched. It's not globally defined. So the resolution is to is just, again, if we look at separating the background and the fluctuation, we find that we can write the Bianchi identity for this thing for just the fluctuation of F5 as the total derivative of something. And if I don't have a delta, it's just the background. You can actually do this, you know, to higher order, but we'll just look at the linear order part. So delta F5 looks like D of some delta C4 prime minus this stuff. And okay, since this comes about because the d of it is zero, we know that this delta C4 prime is globally defined, you can actually explicitly work out the transformation of the normal fluctuation of C4 delta C4 to what delta C4 prime is, and show explicitly in terms of the gauge transformation that this thing is globally defined. So you can separate out essentially fluctuations in C2 and B2 from C4. And if you want to understand or know properly what the actual part of C4, the degrees of freedom of C4 that you can dimensionally reduce that are sensibly periodic and everything, you have to do this. And it has real consequences for the C2 and B2 equations of motion. Because when I now vary F5 with respect to these things, I get something different than what I would have had before. So there's a similar issue for the fact that you have higher dimensional D brains, right? Those are magnetic sources for what we might call the base RR potentials, the ones with the lower ranks in supergravity. Okay, so we can, you can sort of avoid this issue by, and this is what most people do, and even if you, go look at any textbook, right? They'll talk about the coupling of brains, like even say a D7 or a D8 brain. They'll talk about an RR8 potential, 8-form potential, or 9-form potential. This is implicitly using what's called the democratic formulation of supergravity, right? So you have RR potentials of sort of every rank from zero or maybe minus one up to 9 or 10 alternating. And then at the end, after you're done doing all your calculations, you work only with the equations of motion, so you avoid any of this Bianchi identity nonsense, sort of. And then at the end, you impose duality of relations. I can say you can avoid this issue sort of because the Bianchi identities are still actually there. But the cost, doubling the Ramon degrees of freedom. And that gives you sort of more bookkeeping later. And it's sometimes not the right word. You just need to be a little bit careful when doing the dualities, because you're working with twice as many objects or degrees of freedom as you should have. So what we want is a theory of just the lower rank potentials with all the D brains, really all brains, but do D brains. And what we can do is we can follow, we can go all the way back to Dirac's 1948 paper on magnetic monopoles, where he saw, essentially, before anyone even knew about gauge patching, he solved this problem by introducing dynamical variables for the string singularity. And this was generalized to brains by Teitelbaum. And in fact, this sort of theory of supergravity with D-brains was actually worked out in large part by Kriglia and Lechner in 2004. And I'll explain a little bit what they did. They worked it out for the 2B theory, 2B supergravity, actually with general brain intersections. So that's more than I even care about doing. So a lot of the results that I'm going to talk about, at least in their 2B form, were derived already here in a really nice paper. They were mostly interested in anomalies on brains and brain intersections. And because of that, they actually had to be a little more clever mathematically than what I'm going to do. Although their mathematical apparatus turns out not to be suitable for what I want to do. So I've got to actually have to stick to Dirac's formalism. I'll talk about that very briefly later, assuming I keep up with as fast as I want to go. The main thing is that I want to talk about is they identified new terms in the supergravity action in the presence of brains. In particular, this modifies the Chern-Simons terms. And I think this is not well known at all. But. So a lot of what I'm going to talk about sort of is a way of reproducing their results, but maybe with a different emphasis or an alternate derivation. But I think I'll also try to point out some new things. And I'll mostly work in the type 2A supergravity. So those are new results there. Okay. And I'll try to move a little bit faster. So let's just set this up. I'm going to look back at D-brain currents. And Dirac brains, what I'll call them. They're the higher dimensional generalization of Dirac strings. Okay. So, and I'm just ignore any higher order alpha prime corrections in D-brain actions, but so now, you know, if we have a brain, its coupling to the RR fields is given by this WZ action. So its world volume is M. There's some formal sum of RR potentials, and F is the world volume gauge field, plus or minus, depending on convention, the RR2 form. And I'll put a eta there where eta is just a sign, plus or minus one. And this is in the usual, the way it's typically written down in a textbook. And again, that's implying sort of a democratic formulation of the supergravity. And so on the other hand, if you want to write down an action where you have kinetic term plus potential dotted with current, like you would do in normal, relativistic notation for Maxwell theory, this leads to currents J. And if we're looking at, for example, the, I guess that should be P for a P brain. There's a current coupled to CP plus one on the P plus one dimensional world volume. And again, there are cases where you have to be a little more clever mathematically than this. But basically, it's just a form that sort of takes whatever it's contracted with, pulls it back to the world volume, and then evaluates only on the world volume. But similarly, there's actually, because of this, this same D-brain And I guess I should, sorry, there's rain charge there. Also has currents for, or that couple to the lower forms, like that. But from the space-time point of view, okay, if we have a, in a, again, in a democratic formulation, those just couple usually to the you know, all the RR forms, like an electric current. So these can be electric, which show up in the equations of motion. So B star F P plus 2 is, well, there's a sign. Plus possible other terms. Or,
so in principle, we also have other lowering verbs, right?
Here you that's right. You could have, you know, as long as the, you know, until you soak up all the indices. Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah, so, right, a five brain would contribute to, well, the six form current, four form current, two form, and zero form. Okay. But if we're doing sort of a non-democratic, I don't know what the right word for that kind of supergravity is, formulation of supergravity, they're not, you know, these can show up as magnetic sources in Bianchi identities. It's the 7 minus P current coupling to the P plus 2 Bianchi identity. And again, other terms. And there's some sign convention that's as yet undetermined for each of these, each different field strength. Okay. Now I look at this, I say current, okay, current should be conserved. So if I take the D star of each of these currents, if it's a conserved current, I expect it should be zero, right? But this is not the case. D star J has a non-zero term or contribution on the brain boundary. So if the brain, if our brain ends on a larger brain, then there's a source there, or not a source, some anomaly in the current, or end from the world volume exterior derivative of this world volume flux. Okay. Now for a brain ending on another brain, on a larger brain, the smaller brains boundary contribution cancels the world volume exterior derivative, world volume Bianchi identity on the larger brain, point by point. This is the fact that saying, for example, well, it's like the higher dimensional version of saying, or it's like saying a D1 brain ending on a D3 brain, that endpoint's a magnetic monopole in the D3 world volume, and the whole thing turns into a bion. So in some cases, these can cancel. The DM terms generally cancel. DF2 terms. But that's not true when there's a field strength for this, for the NS2 form. So not so when H3 is not zero. And the way that this works is that if you sum over brains, and ignoring boundary terms and things that cancel. In other words, the sort of non-conservation of the P plus one current is given by a higher brain current wedged with H3. And the way that this works out is that there are, well, it's these dot, dot, dots. And it seems like these equations would be inconsistent, but there are the so-called transgression terms and Chern-Simons terms in the equations of motion and Bianchi identities. Okay, so if we just, so the answer to this question is in the additional terms in the equations of motion and Bianchi identities. So we sort of generally write the most general thing down at sort of linear order in these field strengths. And actually, we can be even more general than this if we want. Okay. If you work with supergravity much at all, these things will be familiar, but you know, the point is just that it's not just the brain sources that show up. And if you actually look at the integrability conditions for these, they relate that sign convention eta to these various coefficients and sign conventions. Sorry, this should be a tilde. And everything's consistent. Again, in the supergravities, also, well, these things come from our definition of the field strength, right? Like I wrote down before for F5. And let's set all these beta tildes equal to each other. More later. From the action then, so this term in the field strength gives us not just that contribution to the Bianchi identity, but also this term. So alpha p. minus beta. And that's the same for all sort of the basic forms. What this means, if we're careful by looking at sort of all, you know, the different equations of motion and Bianchi identities, we can actually show that, in fact, these sign conventions have to alternate. They're not the same. So for example, in type 2a, the sign for the D6 brain contribution to this, the F2 Bianchi identity is the is the opposite. Of like the D4. Sorry, I lost my train of thought first. So in either supergravity, it's either 10D supergravity. Beta P and beta P plus 2 equal minus 1. The only way you can avoid that is if you choose a weird convention where you have different signs here in the field strength. And that's something that's come up in, you know, I see it various places as people just using it, but I don't think it's really appreciated. And again, I think that's an, you know, just an important odd feature of the supergravities. Okay. All right, so now we can follow Dirac and actually separate out the dependence of the, you know, the field strengths on the brain condition so that they're not hidden in the potential. And Dirac's idea is that if you can find some form, let's call it K, that's, okay, now we're gonna go to D dimensions for a second, such that D star K is star J for your magnetic source. Then you define your field strength. Fp plus 2 is dcp plus 1 plus whatever these transgression type terms that you need plus your sign. Actually, there's a minus 1 to the d here, but let's not worry about that. And you put your star k dp minus 2. And this solves the Bianchi identity. And as far as Dirac was concerned, and Heitelboim, and Greeley, and Lechner, that's fine because this just sort of sucks all the you know, you think of this as a maybe some sort of generalized flux tube, sucking all the, you know, badness of the Bianchi identity away. So this is a nice and globally defined thing. That's right. CP plus one is global. Well, CP plus 1 and its fluctuation, they're all globally defined.
What is CP plus 1?
Yeah. If K satisfies this. Okay, so now okay, Kriegle and Lechner used something they call a churn kernel for K. These are essentially generalizations of, like, say, the magnetic field around a monopole to higher dimensions. But if you want to try to vary them with respect to, say, the brain position, I mean, yes, all the dependence on the brain position is here, but there's no known closed form, as far as they could tell me, for what, you know, how this depends on. So I'm actually going to go back to Dirac's version. And this is sort of mathematically not as good because it's more singular. But basically what we do is we define a Dirac grain with world volume n such that the boundary of n is the world volume of the magnetic source or the magnetic brain that we're considering. Okay. And then you already said the currents, brain currents, I'm not sure where it went, have a divergence are non-conserved on their boundaries. So the Dirac brain current has D star J equals, well, star of the brain, physical brain. Actually, I care about compactifications, so I can't do this. I have to be more careful, because if, say, my D brain is filling up the entire non-compact part of space-time, then the Dirac brain can only extend in the compact directions. It can't carry the flux off to infinity because there is no infinity for it to carry it off to. So you need sort of double-ended Dirac brains. So in a compactification, we take the boundary of N to be the world volume of the physical D brain minus some reference world volume. Okay? So in other words, the Dirac brain runs from our dynamical D brain to a fixed reference brain. Now, if you're really thinking ahead, you might say, oh, but why do, you know, I don't need to do this because there's a Gauss law constraint that says the total number of charges on my compactification has to add to zero. So I could just run from one physical brain to another physical brain. Except for all these terms. Because those mean the charges can actually be dissolved into these bulk fluxes. So the total D brain charge does not have to add to zero. Only these things have to integrate to zero. So you're not even saved by the Gauss law constraint. And this is the easiest way I can think of to deal with. Okay. I'll draw an example in a minute. But because this is a fixed world volume, and we'll add sort of some fixed reference world volume gauge field, all the dynamics of the D brain are still in this Dirac brain term, not in here. Now, CP plus one is no longer globally defined. It's got to have some gauge patching, but around the fixed reference brain, not about anything dynamic. So I'll squeeze in. Okay. I think to save time, I'll just say this and not write out all the details. But there's two other things. One is, again, if we're careful, when we take D star J of the Dirac brain, we don't just get, well, we also get some term like this, So again, as a formal sum of forms, well, let me write it this way. The higher dimensional Dirac grain has this sort of relationship. So it's basically the same thing as you have for a D-brain because it's the same mathematical construction. It's the same kind of current. And furthermore, because of this, if you plug it back into the field strength, so now FP plus 2 is this thing. This automatically solves the Bianchi identity up there. This thing's not globally defined, so it cancels this part. This gives part of the FP wedge H3, part of the Bianchi identity. This gives the magnetic source, and it gives a Dirac brain term that fills in to make that F tilde P sort of complete its full thing. Okay. And just for fun, I think I'll draw an example of a brain ending on a brain. So here's, say, a D6 brain, and I've got a D4 brain bion ending on it. Right? So it creates a little magnetic monopole. And I should draw a reference brain for this one. And there's a Dirac brain stretching from one to the other. And there should also be a Dirac brain for my six brain. Or sorry, there's a reference brain for the six brain and a Dirac brain stretching in between. Okay, this reference brain is still ending on the physical brain. I've got to still have to extend my world volume gauge field. There's some reference gauge field over here. And it's got to be continuously connected to the gauge field on this one. So there's sort of a line of non-trivial Bianchi identity there. And you'll notice this Dirac brain is sort of missing part of its boundary here. And it actually all fits together kind of nicely. This extra boundary of this Dirac brain is actually the Dirac string for the world volume monopole going to the reference world volume monopole. And this sort of string of non-trivial Bianchi identity in the Dirac brain world volume sort of from the point of view of the supergravity potentials just extends this reference world volume down to the other reference D4 brain down to the reference D6 brain. Short on time, so I'm just sketching that really fast. Okay. But that example sort of shows all the things that you need to do. Okay, so look at the supergravity action with brains. And as I mentioned before, Kariglia and Lechner found sort of new terms. And they used a space-time anomaly argument to argue that there had to be sort of additional terms, well, given for them in terms of those churn kernels. And they're part of the churn assignment action. I'll try to give, well, at least I'll sketch two new derivations for these. And one, and I'll mostly focus on the 2A case because they didn't look at that one. There's a question? Yeah.
Can you say again why we need a buffering spring?
Yeah. It's if say, say we're looking at a compactification with four non-compact directions and six compact ones, and we've got a D3 or D4 brain that fills the entire non-compact directions, then this, where did I put it? That equation, D star K equals star J, you integrate it over the compact dimensions. The left-hand side's automatically zero. The right-hand side just picks up whatever the charge of that the actual D brain is. So that equation's not consistent. So you need an equation where sort of there's a net charge subtracted off. So the total net charge is zero. And you can't just count on there being oppositely charged physical D brains in order to do that, because again, because of those extra terms in the equations of motion and Bianchi identities, people usually say brain charge dissolves in flux, but there's sort of diffuse charge that, so that the total net actual charge on brains does not have to be zero. So you kind of unavoidably have to have some new, arbitrary mathematical object that sort of sits there holding the charge for you, more or less. Then it could run off. Then you could, so if there are non-compact directions transverse to the brain, then your Dirac brain could just say run off to infinity and you're fine. You don't have to have this. But just to sort of be consistent, and the cases that are of particular interest to me, the brains are space-time filling, non-compact filling. I want to include the reference. Okay. So the first argument for these new Chern-Simons terms is the independence of the EOM from, well, these Dirac brains are sort of just mathematical objects. So the Dirac brain currents shouldn't show up anywhere explicitly on their own, or in other words, the equations of motion should be written always in terms of the actual field strengths F tilde. So we look at these equations of motion. The alpha tilde terms come from Chern-Simons form parts of the action. So if we have a typical CS Chern-Simons action, and this is sort of what, if you go again, look up a action of the supergravities in a textbook, you'll see something that you can put into some form like this, at least in the absence of brains. But the variation of this with respect to CP plus one gets two contributions. There's, of course, just varying this. And that term's fine, right? It's written in terms of this, the field strength, which is a well-defined variable. But I've also got to vary the C inside of F tilde and integrate by parts. And when you do that, you get some additional Dirac brain current term. And so you can remove this. A second part of the Chern-Simons action, the sum P. This. And so there's some additional term in the supergravity action that sort of explicitly depends on what's usually thought of as an arbitrary mathematical Dirac brain current. Okay. But it's there so that actual physical things, the equations of motion, don't depend on the arbitrary stuff. Okay. So I think maybe I'll try to just very quickly actually, I think I'll skip over the other derivation. I was going to go through another way to get this, which is basically you can start with the democratic formulation of a supergravity. So again, imagine that all your deep brains are just electric charges and you've got extra potentials so that everything, all the couplings are electric. Then you don't have any Chern-Simons actions. You just have the kinetic terms and the electric couplings. You introduce Lagrange multipliers to write the higher rank field strengths in terms of their potentials and Dirac brains, and then integrate out the higher rank field strengths and potentials. When you do that, you end up with just, again, the lower rank potentials like we want, but some of the mismatching between terms gives you the usual Chern-Simons action. But if you're careful, and there are a few subtle points, which actually led me to try to figure out, well, how do you, and what does it mean to integrate over a gauge field that's not, you know, that's defined only patchwise? That's a slightly subtle question. And integrating by parts against these things is also slightly subtle. But if you're careful, you not only get this Chern-Simons term, but you get this, and in fact, you get another term involving only Dirac brains. So let me write down what you get for the 2A supergravity. And they say the Kreglia and Lechner paper does this, again, using a different type of argument for type 2B, and they come up with the same kind of terms. Yeah.
Like adding some like local counterterm?
It's obviously coming from sort of a different reasoning in the sense that it's not that I'm getting a divergence from loops that I have to kill. But this sort of argument is basically saying, okay, let's take the typical action, and we see that it's not quite consistent or doesn't actually give us the equation of motion that it's supposed to. So what other term do we have to add to get the correct equation of motion? However, like I said, you can also start from like a democratic formulation of the supergravity, where everything's very clear. In fact, the only terms are the kinetic terms, including the appropriate definitions of the field strengths, and the electric couplings to the brains. And if you Poincaré dualize half of the field strengths, then you end up also with these terms, plus more. So I'm just going to write down the result. Actually, I'll just write where you start and where you end up. So a democratic to a supergravity, well, we still have field strengths. We still have to have the Dirac brain terms in the field strengths because the field strengths still have non-trivial Bianchi identities. It's just that nobody ever uses them if they're sort of working with the democratic supergravity. Well, you can choose either the Bianchi identities or the equations of motion, then you force things to be dual at the end. But the initial action in the democratic formulation if we include the Riemann's mass okay, there's kinetic terms for all the field strengths. Plus there's electric couplings for all the potentials and all the brains. Okay. And then you add Lagrange multipliers for all those to dualize them away. So basically you use a Lagrange multiplier method, and in the end, if you're careful, and I think I'll wrap up shortly after this. The kinetic terms, right, of the lower rank field strengths are doubled because, well, now and that to the canonical values. Plus you have your usual electric couplings. But then you also end up with, depending on your sign conventions you choose, this Chern-Simons term that I talked about with the additional part. So there's a second, you know, this, well, it's really a third derivation of this extra term. And then, you also get wedge products of the Dirac brain currents for the magnetic brains with now Dirac brain currents for electrically charged brains. And they just show up. They're apparently topological in the sense that if you vary, say, the brain equation, brain positions, they don't contribute to the equations of motion. But Curley and Lechner say that, well, the particular space-time anomalies they're looking at require these, the presence of these terms. So this is consistent with their argument. And again, they worked on the 2B supergravity and found basically the same kind of thing. I think given the time, I'll just sort of state the other stuff. You can check gauge invariance of this, and it works out. Normally, without brains, the CS term, C3, F4, H3 is gauge invariant by itself. But with brains, you need all these terms together to be gauge invariant. I threw in the zero form field strength, which, if you've heard about Raman's massive supergravity, this is the mass term in the massive 2A supergravity. And when people write down the massive 2A supergravity, there's sort of weird looking extra terms involving B2 in these field strengths, which are reproduced exactly by the Dirac brain currents for an ape brain. So I would speculate, in fact, and this has been speculated before, but without sort of deriving the form of the action, right? The massive supergravity is sort of just the reaction of 2A supergravity to the presence of ape brains. And in particular, all the couplings of the mass term are due to the, well, there's some stuff in here that source F2 and F3. But also the weird terms in the field strengths due to the Raman's mass are just due to the Dirac brain current. And in fact, there are additional parts of the Chern-Simons term. And I haven't been able to get the precise numerical coefficients to work out yet, but the structure is the same, so I think it's probably right. So it'd be one speculation. I'm not gonna have time to go through the application, but you know, the whole point was to sort of be able to work with sort of the brain equations of motion separated out from the flux equations of motion or the flux degrees of freedom for say dimensional reduction of compactifications, but you can work that out as well. And some of that's appeared in other places, but not comprehensively, so I'm trying to put that together. Other things that sort of I haven't figured out yet, but I think would be interesting to do would be to extend this to include NS5 brains, because of course, those are magnetic sources for B2. I think that's probably gonna wait, because a lot of the arguments would have to be, have relied on the fact that H3 is closed, and that fails in the presence of NS5 brains. So a lot of this would have to be modified. And in fact, if we're looking at 2B supergravity in particular, there's an additional Chern-Simons term, at least in some of the textbooks in 2B supergravity, that's B2, C2, F3, H3. And most of the time people ignore that because it's topological in the absence of brains. If you only have D brains, it's still a total derivative, so it doesn't contribute to the UM. If you have both D5 brains and NS5 brains, it's not. It's actually a real contribution to the action classically. So I'd be interested in seeing sort of the effect of that and how it's modified. But I, like I say, that's an interesting thing to the future. Okay, thanks very much.
Actually,
it does depend on
the position
of the reference brain. So, I will confess I haven't entirely understood this yet. I believe the correct statement is that actually it's something like what Kriglia and Lechner were talking about when they're talking about the anomaly they were focusing on was the fact that the Dirac brain, or in their case, the Chern kernel, has some arbitrariness in it. Arbitrariness. And so changing the configuration of the Dirac brain doesn't actually necessarily leave the action invariant, but it generates an anomaly. That anomaly should vanish in the quantum theory due to the Dirac charge quantization argument. And in order to get that to happen was why they had to introduce some of these vectors. And so I think that the correct statement is that it's not necessarily an invariance of the action, but when combined with the correct charge quantization, then it's an invariance of the path integral. I think it's more that the variation of the action is an integral multiple of 2 pi in the appropriate units.
Oh, okay.
But like I say, I haven't entirely understood that. But I mean, I can say this comes from this action, which is manifestly even this, because there's Dirac brains here, it's not super clear. This field strength in the end is independent of the Dirac brain configuration, but that is also partly because of the equations of motion. So if I'm not on shell, I'm not sure if the action is independent of the Dirac brain configuration either.
Any more questions?
Okay, thank you.